me remind you that, just by way of reminding, that I'm putting out outlines about 30 minutes before the evening lesson. So when you come in, they are on the table in the foyer. If you would like to get one of those and have it during the lesson, they're out there. And if you'd like to pick up one and get it on the way out to have a reference to the lesson, obviously you can feel free to do that. Seem to manage to do this about once a week. So. Open to the book of Job and go back with me to chapter 3. I'm going to very briefly pick up there, and then if you're looking at your outline, and then I'll very quickly get back to chapter 6. I want to welcome everyone who's here this evening. And especially, we are glad to have Miss Hannah, who I trust will become a familiar face around here. And she is already, to most, if not all of us, but really glad to have her home from Florida. But to everyone that is here, I hope you enjoyed your day. And for all of you mothers, I hope it was made as special as it should be for you this day. Now to turn to a more depressing pattern. This is probably the most depressing lesson. We will reach a low point with Job in this lesson. I would suppose there is one other that many would look at as a lower point still. But this one is, I kind of look at the one, and it'll make sense when we talk about it. I kind of look at that one as going as low as he can go, but he starts to work through things, so that's very helpful. But this lesson tonight, and some of the things where Job contemplates the whole point of life, you might have gathered that from the reading that Kenny did, and commend both Kenny and Edward for the songs they chose today. And in fact, I want to go back and start the lesson tonight with this song that Edward led, number 37. I hope you were looking at the words of it, because, "Dear Father, guide my wayward soul." This is a song you would sing that would express the sentiment that Job is really expressing. Guide my wayward soul and teach me how to pray. For when I need your care the most, I often turn away. Verse 2 of number 37 says, and especially verses 2 and 3, the second part of the song, is what fits so well with the lesson. The sins and woes that plague my flesh corrupt my spirit too. We really see that, and we will in this lesson tonight. Job's flesh is not only corrupted, his spirit is failing very fast. They scatter doubt within my heart and take me far from you. So help me, Lord, when I depart, to turn again to prayer, that I may both receive your love and see you in your care. Amen. Excellent song. I appreciate that, Edward, for choosing that. Go with me to the book of Job, and let's talk about Job as he contemplates the point of life. As he sits there in anguish, being not comforted by the three who have come to do just that, perhaps four, I'm not sure when Elihu, no one knows exactly when Elihu joins the group, but especially the three, he's not being comforted by them. He's certainly not being comforted at all by God at this point. There's no evidence of that. He's being tested. And as he sits there and begins to lament where he is, we've already seen in chapter 3, and we looked at this last week, Job says, "I wish I was never born." Okay, if I had to be born, I wish I'd died at birth. And if all of that's not the case, and obviously that's not going to be possible because there he sits in midlife in the condition he's in, then I just wish I could die. And it's very depressing when you see that. And as you go through the book, if you think that's just a fleeting moment that he has, it's not. I'm going to look at some passages tonight, but by no means all of them. I mean, we would be here quite a long time if I were to explore every time in the book that he expresses something like that. But he continues this sentiment, and his depression grows, and you see it growing as the book develops. When you come to chapter 6, and if you're there with me, go back to chapter 6 again and look at verse 2. When Job says, "Oh, that my grief were thoroughly weighed, and my calamity laid in the balances together." There comes a point in time when, and if you're going through something like this, where you know that no one else understands what you're going through. I mean, people may say, "I know exactly what you're going through." The three attempt, to a degree, to say that, but not really. And sometimes when you're trying to comfort someone, or you want to comfort someone, you're tempted to say, I know exactly how you feel. And if you've ever made that mistake, you may have had someone quickly come back at you and say, you don't know how I feel. Because you can't know how I feel unless you went through something exactly like I've gone through. And the truth is, none of us go through exactly what anybody else goes through. And I mean, the circumstances are the same. That part is true. But we're individuals. So where I might break an arm and react to it one way, you might break an arm and respond to it a different way. You know, we're different as individuals. So Job is inclined to look at the three and say, you don't have a clue. You don't know what this feels like. You don't know why it happened. You really just don't know anything. And he will get to that point. But right now, he's just pretty much saying, I wish that it could be somehow weighed. And if you see that in verse 2, I wish that my grief were thoroughly weighed. I wish it could be exposed. I wish people could really understand just how bad it is. Now, so that you can have an idea, he will go on to say, if you're looking down in verse 8, and pick up reading there with me, and let me read just this paragraph. Oh, that I might have my request, as Kenny read it a moment ago, and that God would grant me the thing that I long for. Now, if you listen to the reading, and I'm not going to reread the whole thing, but if you listen to the reading, you know what he's saying there. He wants to die. In fact, it's amazing when he says in verse 9, if you're looking at that, and go back to this very strange verse here and very strange terminology within it. Even that it would please God, notice, to destroy me. Literally in the original language, the word destroy means that God would beat me in pieces. Now, a person might look at Job, what he's going through, and say, well, man, you know, what God has done or allowed to happen, you know, whatever, however way you want to look at that, what God has done or allowed to happen is about as far as anybody I've ever seen. But Job is just saying, you know, just get it over with. I mean, just beat me in pieces. Oh, that God, I could have my request and that it would please God to destroy me, that he would let loose his hand and cut me off. You see his depression growing. You see his hopelessness. It's setting in. He just wants to end it. Amazing, more amazing still, is this in verse 10, that he says, then should I have comfort. And then this phrase, depending on your translation, if you've got a King James or a couple of other obscure translations, it says something like, I would harden myself in sorrow or pain or suffering or whatever. But if you've got most translations, other translations, it says, I would rejoice or I would exult in my suffering. Now those seem like two completely different ideas. To harden myself in my sorrow or my pain, or to rejoice in it. And neither one of them, one of them we can almost see, you know, yeah, people become hardened through everything they suffer, but that's not good. And so how could he long to basically be, you know, as we would look at it, maybe hard-hearted or hardened or whatever. I don't think he's saying that. And it would take a real sadomasochistic person to say, you know, let me enjoy it, man. I mean, it's great. It's going to hurt me. I enjoy that. I mean, we look at that. Somebody that goes through that is kind of strange. So what in the world is he saying? It may surprise you to know that this word that is used for harden or exult or rejoice is only used in Job chapter 6. It doesn't occur anywhere else. And in fact, it's not even really a Hebrew word. But it is a perfect word for this book. It's really more of a Chaldean word or an Aramaic word. And at the time that, you know, Job is probably being written, Aramaic is not really the language of the Jews, but they're very close sister languages. So it'd be kind of like, you know, languages we have today that are very close to English, and we borrow terms and they just kind of creep in and become a part of our language. Reconnaissance and surveillance and, you know, French words like that are just English words now. Well, it's kind of like that here. And the word that's been borrowed is one that is used like a person who would work in a blacksmith shop or tempering steel or something like that. And it's the idea of putting steel or iron in a fire so that it burns and it warms And so that is where you get the idea, the use for it, of exalt or rejoice or something like that. But it also hardens it. I mean, when you put iron in a fire and you know, you get it hot and you shape it and so forth, and then it cools and it's hardened, it's stronger. Really what Job is saying here, I believe, and a lot of debate about it, tremendous amount. But I really believe that what Job is saying here is, I want to get to the point where I don't feel it. Now, that can be positive or negative. Where you can get to the point where you're numb to it, it doesn't hurt you anymore, it doesn't bother you anymore. He wants to be numbed to the pain. He wants to be hardened to it so that if he's going to rejoice, and it really doesn't mean it in that sense, so I don't like that translation, even though hardened is not a perfect translation either. But the idea is, if he's going to rejoice, he's going to rejoice for two things. One, because he doesn't hurt like he's been hurting. And two, because as you see in the context, God is going to kill him and get it over with. Now when you look at that kind of hopelessness, you get the sense of what Job is feeling. And you have to read these speeches understanding that. So before we dig deeper into the book and we contemplate God's position and man's position and where justice enters into all of this and all the things we're going to look at, I want us to see the standpoint, the viewpoint, if you will, the tone, as it would be called in literature, from which Job is coming. And it's hopelessness. It's pointlessness. It's reaching a point where if this is life, if life is to have everything and lose everything, if life is to be what I once was a few months ago, he will say at one point in the book, and come to this point, if that's what it is, then I don't want to live, get it over with. He's gone so far he can't see ever being restored. I mean, we know the end of the book. But if you were living in this and going through it, you can't see it. It's just impossible. You can't get this far into pain, this far into a problem, and see past it. I mean, you can work through it, but you're not just going to, I mean, unless you're some kind of superhuman, you couldn't reach this point of this suffering and just look down the road and say, you know, I can just see everything being rosy here in a few days. I mean, that's just not where he is. So as you look at verses 11 and 12, I mean, he asks the question. He's asking it of the friends. I think he's asking it of God. He's asking it of himself. For anybody who wants to ever listen in posterity. You, me. Well, what do you think my strength is? How strong do you think I am? Sometimes when you're suffering and someone comes to you and says, I know you and I know how strong you are. I mean, you can get beaten down to the point where you really just want to scream at somebody. You know, well, how strong do you think I am? You think my strength is like that of a rock? You think my flesh is like brass? How strong do you think I am? You just see the hopelessness settling in here. Look at verse 13 when he finally comes to this point here in this paragraph of saying, is not my help in me? And this is really a Hebraism that basically says, my help is all in myself. And boy, that's not much. In other words, there is no question. And he will say it in the book, so I'm not reaching for something here that's not there. He's called out to God, and God hasn't answered. He's not said no, but he's not said anything. And Job is used to, if I understand the setting of the book, the time and all of that kind of thing, Job is used to calling out to God, calling upon God. If this is indeed the first book or set in the most ancient of times, this would be what's called the oral period. And God is speaking to these people. Well, he's not speaking to Job. And Job laments that. I cry out to him, and he's not there. So he knows there's no help from God. I mean, that's the way he feels. I understand that. I'm not trying to say there is none, but that's how he feels. No hope from God, and there certainly isn't any hope from anything around him. And if these three friends that have traveled so far to be with him, to so-called comfort him, if that's the best there is, there ain't no help from anybody around him. So he has no help. His only help is in himself, and that's not much. So the end result is, I have no real help. I'm in this terrible condition I'm in, and there just is no help. I'll tell you something else that isn't any help. And if you've ever known people who reach an extreme state of depression or whatever in life, they will tell you this. One of the most discomforting things there is, one of the most surprising things, I suppose. Look at chapter 7 for a moment. We get used to in life of, we have problems, everyday problems. I mean, that's part of life, right? We have situations we have to deal with. We get sick, and we don't feel good. But there's always one place you can go for relief for a few hours, and that's when you go to sleep. You don't feel good, you're sick, you're miserable, you go to bed. And generally speaking, you wake up, you feel a little better. When life is crashing in on you, you know, beats you down or whatever, you know you got to handle it, you got to get up and deal with it tomorrow, you go to bed. And it feels good to go to sleep. And you forget it. But there are certain things in life, the most difficult things in life. And you get depressed from them, you get to a point where sleep is no relief. Now I want you to read this passage with me in chapter 7. Down in verse 13, Job says this, "When I say, my bed shall comfort me, my couch shall ease my complaint, then thou scarest me with dreams, and terrifiest me through visions, so that my soul chooses strangling, and death rather than my life. I loathe it. I would not live always. Let me alone, for my days are vanity." What's going on here? He's so depressed, he's reached a point where he doesn't go to bed and forget it. He goes to bed and he has nightmares. Professionals, those who know these things, will tell you that your dreams are a way of dealing with your emotions. All kinds of emotions. We have a wide range of them. We love, we hate, we're afraid, we're brave, we're adventurous, etc., etc. That's why you dream about everything. You dream about love relationships and jumping off a cliff and flying and everything under the sun. But when you're consumed with grief and you're consumed with depression, you carry it to bed with you and you dream about it. And there's never any relief. There's never any of those pleasant dreams where you wake up and you're so refreshed and it was so wonderful and you're like, oh man, I wish I'd go back to sleep and keep dreaming that, you know. None of those. Night after night after night after night. It's nothing but a nightmare. So that there's no relief day or night. And so that you never get to a point where you say, I'll be glad when sleep comes, because at least I'll have relief, reprieve for a couple hours. There's none. I wish I were dead. It's a horrible state to be in. Finally, look with me, if you will, at chapter 10. When he says it like this in verse 1. And this is interesting for a couple of reasons. But one thing he says is this. My soul is weary of my life. Now, that's interesting for several points. I mean, he says something here that the theologian, he immediately latches onto it and gets off on a tangent. But before we do that, let's look at the fact of what Job said. My soul is weary of my life. There's an inward part of man, the real part, if you will, the eternal part. It's your soul. It's the part that is going to be affected by everything in life for as long as we live it. And it is what ultimately all these circumstances of life are going to affect that part of your life, and you're going to carry that into eternity. So that if you enjoy life and you're blessed and you're thankful to God and you serve God because of it, you're going to die and go to heaven and eternity is going to be great. And if things like this beat you down to the point that you give up on God, as he is in danger of doing here, when you give up on God and you abandon God and you are separated from God, you don't have relief at death. You die and you go to hell and you suffer for all eternity. But you reach a point where the circumstances of life have affected your soul. My soul is weary of my life. Now the theologian grabs onto this and says, you know, this is very complicated for an ancient book. I mean, basically, the modern thought goes like this. I'm not going to get too deep into it because I don't want to get off on a tangent. But the modern concept is that over the centuries, man developed this idea of his soul, and then all his theology and religion to go with it. His soul is eternal, and he's going to, you know, it's going to face judgment, if you believe in all of that, and it's going to go to heaven and hell and all of that. But ancient people, they will tell you, had no concept of a soul. They had no concept of life being that complicated. They looked at themselves like they looked at animals. They live, they die. You know, they're alive one moment, throw a spear in them, they fall over dead. They see a human being, he's alive, he falls over dead, same thing. But you realize when you look at this, wait a minute. You know, this is an extremely ancient book. At least conservatives will tell you that. It's one reason why liberals don't want to believe it is. But this is an extremely complicated view of life, a complex view of life. He sees life as involving a part of him. Let's just say it like that. Life involves his soul. Life is constituted by his soul suffering, as it were, inside his body. And the point here is, my soul is weary of my life. Now, as it goes on in this chapter, again, I don't want to get too deep off onto that tangent, so let's bring it back. Here's what he says. Drop down to the end of this chapter and look at verse 18. He asks why. I love the why questions in the book of Job, especially the ones that are coming from Job. But he says, wherefore then, or why then, hast thou brought me, why hast thou brought me forth out of the womb? Oh, that I had given up the ghost, notice that, or the spirit, and no eye had seen me. What's he saying there? What does he understand? He understands that in his mother's womb, there was an eternal part of him that could separate from that body. Oh, that I had given up the ghost and no eye had seen me. I should have been as though I had not been. I should have been carried from the womb to the grave. I put that on your outline because that's an astonishing statement. Notice the difference here. Not chapter 3. I wish I had been carried from the womb to the grave. Chapter 10 is, I should have been. He looks at what's happened to him in life, and not only does he see hopelessness for no future, he looks back and sees pointlessness to having lived. Now, that's real depression. I mean, it's one thing to get to the point where there's not, you know, you just don't feel like there's any reason to go on. A lot of people feel that sometimes. But the worst case of depression is when a person not only sees no reason to go on, they see no reason to have ever been. And that's what he's saying. I should have been carried from the womb to the grave. That's an incredible statement, really, for a person like him to come to. You notice as he concludes in this particular chapter, he says, are not my days few? I'm looking at verse 20. Are not my days few? Cease then. You know, I can't have long to live, then get it over with. It can't be that much longer, so let's end it today. And let me alone, that I may take a little comfort. Before I go, whence I shall not return. Notice as he contemplates the afterlife. Before I go to a place where I cannot return from, even to the land of darkness and the shadow of death. The land of darkness as darkness itself. And of the shadow of death, without any order, and where the light is as darkness. It's an amazing point to come to. Go back a chapter or so to Job 20, chapter 9 and look down at verse 25. Now I'm going to come back to chapter 9 as we get into a whole different discussion. So I'm going to really talk about the context. But you will see him saying the same kind of thing in this particular chapter. Look down at verse 25. Now my days are swifter than a post. A messenger is the idea. Swifter than a post. They flee away. They see no good. Notice that statement. My days see no good. They are passed away as the swift ships and as the eagle that hastens to the prey. To me, that is so sad. When a person gets to the point that they see no good in their life, there's no point to having lived, chapter 10, there's no good in my life now. Just get it over with. It's very sad. Look down at verse 28 in this same chapter. And I really think that a righteous person, and yeah, I would still consider him righteous. You know, you might be thinking, with all the things I've said, I surely don't believe he's a righteous man anymore. You're wrong. I do believe he's a righteous man. I believe he's a righteous man. That's the only thing that saves him in this book. But it's statements like this. I am afraid of all my sorrows. Now, I want to point something out here. And if you're in the habit of writing in your book, I'd star this verse and go back and meditate on it. Because here's the point. Talk to an ungodly person who's going through something like this. And they do. You know, ungodly people lose children, can't deal with it, etc., etc. But talk to an ungodly person, and what comes rolling out of their mouth is the way they feel is completely justified. In other words, I am right for feeling like I feel. I don't know if I've told you guys this. I think I did several years back, but I will tell you this. I was younger than Wes, 3 or 4 years younger. And it was at the first place that I ever preached, and it was something similar to this situation. I worked with an older guy, preached for a congregation, worked with an older guy. And we went out door knocking, he and me and, I don't know, several others. We kind of went to this neighborhood and split up, and we went up and down the street knocking on doors. Long story short is this. Completely not ready for this. I knock on a door. Woman comes to the door, and I introduce myself. You know, I'm visiting such and such Church of Christ down the street and want to invite you to church, whatever it was I said. And she led into me. And she proceeded to tell me and pointed right out on the street, right out there, her little girl of 7 years old had run out in the street, the car had hit her, killed her. She hated God. She hated that book I held in my hand. She hated people like me. In fact, she said, "This is exactly the way I feel about all of you." Right in my face. And I've often said, you know, I've had people ball up a fist and hit me in the face. And I've been spit in the face. I'll take the fist anytime. And I mean that. But it's not just that. It's the fact that she was so overcome with her grief. She would never work through that. It wasn't something that had just happened. This woman was considerably older. No telling when this had happened. Years, I would assume. Listen to Job again. I am afraid of all my sorrows. Why? Because a righteous person sees what it's doing to them. And it's not good. It's not right. I feel that as I looked at this book, I feel that Job's pain is getting the best of him at this point. But there's one redeeming quality he has. He's scared of it. He's scared of what he feels. And that's good. In other words, what I would say to you is this. If you're going through something similar to this, and you've got doubt, I mean, kind of like this song expresses, you know? Here's someone praying. I mean, yes, it's in a song. But here's someone praying, or we were singing the words, and basically what we were saying is, Father, help me when I reach the point that doubts come in, and I'm not feeling like everything's wonderful, and you're a great God today, and everything you've done is just a blessing today. I don't feel that. Help me, because I'm afraid to feel like I feel. I think that's what will save Job. And we're going to come back to that point. But let's just notice as we go on reading here, we'll read it quickly, a couple more things, and then I want to turn to the last couple of points and, you know, won't spend near the amount of time in them. But let's just listen to Job. Job 17, look down at verse 11. God has delivered me to the ungodly and turned me over into the hands of the wicked. I was at ease. In other words, chapter 1, etc. But he's broken me asunder. He's torn me up is the idea. He's also taken me by my neck and shaken me to pieces. And he set me up for his mark. I'm like a target is the idea, literally. His archers compass me round about and he cleaves my reins, my insides is the idea, asunder. He just tears me up inside. And he doesn't spare. He pours out my gall upon the ground. He breaks me. And notice he's saying, God does this. My face is foul with weeping, verse 16. On my eyelids is the shadow of death, and for any injustice in my hands also my prayer is pure. He's saying, I'm telling the truth. I'm not trying to hide anything. I'm praying. I'm saying it to you, my friends, and I'm praying it to God just like it is. And he's that far down. Look at chapter 19 and go down to verse 8. And there's a phrase in particular here that I want to grab onto. He has fenced up my way that I cannot pass, and he set darkness in my path. Notice verse 9. He stripped me of my glory and taken the crown from my head. The crown is like wearing a crown, like a ruler or whatever. He has destroyed me on every side, verse 10. And this phrase in particular, I am gone. You ever known anybody who would be so far down? Have you ever felt like this? But be so far down, so hurt, so messed up inside. And they'll say to you, and they mean it, I'm done. You know, I'm done. I'm finished. It's over. And they're not just being melodramatic. They mean it. I mean, I am so far carried away inside that that's it. That's all there is. That's what Job is saying. I am gone. My hope has removed like a tree. When you listen to Job saying, when he's saying things like that, basically what he's saying here is, what's the point? What's the point of life? To live your life, enjoy some things, sure, but, you know, there was a time I did, but to come to this point is pointlessness. And that's what he sees. I should never have had to live this life. Now, that's scary. Now, let's ask a question. Because you have to ask this question if you're going through this kind of thing. And Eliphaz does. There are very few times when I really appreciate these guys, but really the question, not his answer, because he goes on to answer it, and I don't agree with it at all. But the question is a great one at this point. Look at chapter 22, if you will, and listen to what Eliphaz asked Job in verse 2. Because what's the point of life? Really, why are you here? Yeah, I don't know if you ever sit around and think about that. And I don't necessarily mean, why are you in New Jersey tonight? I mean, why is anybody here? You know? Are we just an accident of slime in a pool 3 billion years ago? Or is there purpose for being here? Why are we here? Well, Eliphaz asked that question. Only Eliphaz misses it. Look at verse 2. Can a man be profitable unto God? Here's what he's basically saying. Job, you seem to be thinking your life is of some importance, that it matters. You don't matter. You're nothing. And I'd venture to say that's most people's feelings about people and life. And you just kind of live it. You know, get some gusto out of it when you can, but, you know. Can a man be profitable to God? Now, there's a philosophical question. Notice as he goes on to say, as he that is wise may be profitable to himself. Now, if you've got a wise person, he profits himself. But God is complete, isn't he? He's everything there is. He's totally self-sufficient. So of what possible value could man be to God? Listen to verse 3. Let me break it down for you, Eliphaz says. Is it any pleasure to the Almighty that you, Job, are righteous, or we might add, or not? Or is it gain to God that you make your ways perfect? A number of years ago, a preacher came to preach a gospel meeting. And the guy said, and this was, basically his sermon was talking about God being self-sufficient. Now, there's a reason to talk about God that way. Certainly God is self-existent. But he went on to make this statement in the sermon, and it just, as I discussed it with him later, I totally disagreed with it. So I'll tell you that up front. But here was his point. Man needs God, he said. But God doesn't need man, and never did. Now my question to him is, okay, fine, why make us? I mean, does God do anything that is of no point at all? That's what Eliphaz seems to be saying here. It doesn't matter to God whether you're righteous. You're getting carried away with yourself, Job. You're looking at your life like it should have been of some great importance, and it really doesn't matter at all. Well, then why did God make me? Why am I here? And does it matter to God today, right now, tonight, if you, sitting where you are, or me standing up here, if I'm faithful to God or I'm not, if I'm righteous or I'm not, if I'm obedient to God or I am not, does it matter to God? Well, you might say, well, sure it matters to God. He cares. And He'll punish you. No, I don't mean that. I'm talking about His feelings. I'm talking about like you value things. You love people. Do you care if you lose them or not? You say, sure. Are you made in the image of God? Oh, yeah. Does He care? I think He cares. And I'm not just looking at my own great wisdom to say that. I don't have any. But let's look to Scripture. Genesis 6. God looks down upon man. What does God say in verse 6? He repented God He'd made man. He regretted, literally. And it grieved Him at his heart. He cared. Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 30 tells us as Christians, grieve not the Holy Spirit. Not don't make Him mad. Don't incur His judgment. Don't grieve Him. You hurt God by sinning. It hurts Him. It's not just that He gets angry and He'll judge you. He hurts. Compare a number of passages in the Bible. Look at Luke 15. And those parables of rejoicing over one sinner that repents. And all the angels in heaven break out in rejoicing. Or the picture we have of God, who's the father of the prodigal son that goes running out to the boy and kills the fatted calf. He cares. Or read with me some Old Testament passages. Look at Proverbs chapter 12 for a moment. Let's just listen to what God says. Proverbs 12 and verse 22. Get to it. Proverbs 12 and verse 22. God says, lying lips are an abomination to the Lord. Now God's saying it by inspiration, obviously. Lying lips are abomination to the Lord, but they that deal truly are His delight. It's not just that they're right, you see, but there is delight. You know, when you think of this word, and this is the kind of word that would be used elsewhere to talk about children are delight to their parents. You, as a faithful individual, are a delight to your father. Notice, if you will, 1 Chronicles chapter 29. I love this passage in particular, so I want to turn over there and read it. 1 Chronicles chapter 20, oops, wrong direction. 1 Chronicles chapter 29, and look down at verse 17. God speaking here, and He says, I know also that thou triest the heart. Of course, Solomon speaking to Him. I know also, my God, that thou triest the heart and hast pleasure in uprightness. But as for me, in the uprightness of mine heart, I have willingly offered all these things. What's he saying in this passage? I understand, God. I understand that you take pleasure now, delight, pleasure in people doing what's right. Let's go back to Eliphaz's point. Does it matter to God if you're right, Job? You bet it does. It absolutely does. Job is sitting there and God is watching this. Now you picture God as the book does. And what God said, we don't have to wonder about this. We have God making the statement to Satan. You put me in a position to do this to him. And God watches Job go through this. And as Job goes through this and he's all torn up and right now he's so low, God is watching this. If Job chooses in this book, if when God comes to him, and we know he does, we all know what the book says. So if when God comes to him, God begins to speak to Job from the whirlwind, and Job looks up at God and says, let me tell you something, God. You hurt me. And I don't want any part of you anymore. You think he had that choice? Do you have it? Do you think it would have mattered to God? It would have hurt God at all? Now, God takes so much pleasure and so much confidence in Job when he starts all of this, but Job has to have free will. So if it reaches that point and Job says, you hurt me too bad, too much, and I don't want any part of you anymore, does God feel anything about that? I'm of personal belief that he does. We listen to Job, and Job begins to sum up his life. And I want you to look at a couple of statements with me. And we'll close this out. But Job begins to look at a couple, or begins to look at himself of value, of consequence. Again, he's depressed, no question about it. So he begins to look at his life, and he says this. Read with me, if you will, chapter 7. He says, is there not an appointed time? It's a military term. It's like a time of service you go through as a soldier, what is the term is generally used for. But he says, is there not an appointed time to man on the earth? Are not his days also like the days of a hireling? I think a lot of people feel this. And I think depressed, and when I say this, you know, it's almost a contradiction of terms, but I think depressed Christians feel this. I'm a slave. I'm a hired man. You know, I enlisted in the service of God and it's painful. And I've heard plenty of people talk like this. So I know what people go through, at least from that standpoint, when they talk this way. As a servant earnestly desires the shadow, a hireling looks for the reward of his work, so I am made to possess months of vanity. That is so depressing. I'm just here on this earth to work for God. You ever known anybody that talked like that? I'm just put here on this earth to work for God, slave for God. Go through all of this pain and then I die. He's kind of going through that. Look with me, if you will, at chapter 14 for a moment. And look down at verses. We don't read it all. Let's just read verses 4 and 5 here. Oops, too far. Job 14, and look down at verse 4. Or just start at verse 5. Job 14, verse 5. Remember in verse 1, he had said, man is born of woman, is of a few days, and full of trouble. Look down at verse 5. Seeing his days are determined. Same word, appointed idea. His days are determined. The number of his months are with thee, as he says to God. Thou, God, has appointed his bounds that he cannot pass. Turn from him that he may rest till he shall accomplish as a hireling his day. That's pointlessness, man. I mean, that's reaching a point where you're basically saying to God, just get it over with. Let me die. Let my time of service be over. And that's his view of life. And basically what he's saying is, you go on and you look at this, I mean, if you really dig into it, what he's saying in these chapters, and that's why Eliphaz will end up objecting. We're going to come back to some of this. But what he's really saying in these chapters that Eliphaz is objecting to is, Job saying, it can't be that. I can't just be a hired man to God. You know what Satan basically said? You pay him off. It can't be that. And I can't just be a slave of God. It's got to be more than that. And we know it is, don't we? And Jesus says it. I've not called you as slaves. I called you as friends. You're not going to spend eternity in heaven like some mindless robot. God's going to wind up and you start singing hallelujah. That's not what this is about. This is a relationship with your father, with your brother, that you're developing over the course of your life, and you're going to spend an eternity in that relationship. Job is saying, it's got to be more than that. The next time I'm going to begin with this contemplation of David. Similar. But David is by no means in the state of mind Job is in. And then we'll go further as Job really begins his speech, not with the friends, but with God. And that is the deepest part of the book we get. If you're here tonight, you're not a Christian. You listen to a lesson like this and you think, man, Christianity must be, you know, you must can get pretty down as a Christian. Yeah. Because you're a human being. You go through things. But I want you to understand, I would not want you to leave tonight thinking that this is where it stays. It doesn't. God is aware of every feeling Job has. Everything he says. And God is going to help him. God is not going to let him go, at least the circumstances, go further than he can handle. Job is not going to fall apart. We know the end of the story. We know the end of the movie. He's not going to fall apart. He's going to work through it. And God is going to be right there for him. That's the God we serve. That lets us be human. Because we want to be. We're made to want to be. But not alone.